the meeting earlier this afternoon of governors and heads of supervision reached a unanimous agreement on the regulation of banks' liquidity through the liquidity coverage ratio, which is a requirement to hold a stock of high-quality liquid assets to cover a net cash outflow over a 30-day period of stress. And this requirement is a key component of the Basel III Accord. It completes the work programme that we set out in 2010 with publication of Basel III. The agreement reached today on the liquidity coverage ratio covers four main areas. First, amendments to the definition of high-quality assets that count towards the LCR, which form the numerator of the ratio, and amendments to the factors that determine the net liquidity outflows that banks might face in stress, which defines the denominator of the ratio. Second, a revised timetable for the introduction of the LCR, which now mirrors the introduction of the capital requirements, by coming fully into effect only in 2019. The LCR will be introduced as planned on the 1st of January 2015, but the minimum requirement will begin at 60% of the final figure, rising in equal annual steps of 10 percentage points to reach 100% on the 1st of January 2019. And this will ensure that the new liquidity standard will in no way hinder the ability of the global banking system to finance a recovery. Third, an agreement that countries with distressed banking systems will have complete flexibility in their application of the LCR until the distress has passed. In other words, a clear public statement that the liquidity buffers defined by the LCR are to be used in times of stress. This is applicable both during the transition and in steady state. There will be no need for banks to hold buffers on buffers. And fourth, it was also agreed today that since deposits with central banks are the most, indeed in some circumstances the only truly liquid asset, the interaction between the LCR and the provision of central bank facilities is of fundamental importance. The Basel Committee will therefore continue to work on this over the next year. But today's agreement is a clear commitment to ensure that banks hold sufficient liquid assets to prevent central banks becoming the lender of first resort. As in the setting of any new international standard, this was a compromise between competing views around the world. But in the end, the willingness of the international community to reach agreement overrode any differences of view about the definition of liquid assets and the appropriate timetable for the introduction of the LCR. This is a very significant achievement. For the first time in regulatory history, we have a truly global minimum liquidity standard for banks. Now central banks and supervisors can press ahead with the next stage of the Basel III Accord, the net stable funding ratio. This is a crucial piece in the jigsaw, extending the scope of international agreement to the structure of banks' debt liabilities. And this will be a priority for the Basel Committee over the next 2 years. The governors and heads of supervision also agreed today a Basel Committee charter, which you have in the papers distributed to you. This will improve public understanding of the committee's activities and decision-making processes. So let me conclude by turning to Stefan Ingves, the chairman of the Basel Committee, to say a little more about the details of the agreement on the LCR before we open this session to questions. Stefan.
Thank you, Mervyn. Well, one way to think about the LCR is to think about it in terms of a global standard that requires banks to maintain a minimum amount of liquid assets that can easily be converted into cash in order to allow the bank to survive cash outflows for a 30-day period of stress. This basic idea, this basic principle when it comes to the design of the LCR and the objective of it has been exactly the same since the Basel Committee agreed on this in December. And the basic structure of the LCR has not changed while we have been discussing how to set it up. To get to this 30-day definition and define in its technical details what it actually means, then one essentially has to deal with two parts of it, because the LCR has been designed as a ratio, and it has stayed that way throughout all our discussions. First one is the numerator, and the issue is how to define what we call HQLA, high quality liquid assets, and what they are, how to define them, what kind of composition one should have when it comes to holding HQLA. Here we're talking about, of course, cash, central bank reserves, government debt securities. And then when it comes to the other part of it, the outflows, which you find in the denominator, the issue is to make reasonable assumptions about the inflows and outflows during a 30-day period. And basically, this is what this conversation has been all about, to define HQLA and then make reasonable assumptions about inflows and outflows in order to get to a ratio that can be used globally. Now, with respect to our discussions about HQLA, what we have done and what we have concluded compared to what was discussed in December 2010 is to broaden the group of high-quality liquid assets that we now include as HQLA, and that includes a broader set of corporate bonds, certain listed equities, and some highly rated mortgage-backed securities. All of these will be subject to various haircuts in order to ensure that you can truly turn them into cash when if need be. In addition to that, we have had a long and detailed conversation about the assumption about the outflows, and we have also made some adjustments when it comes to the outflows, or actually the potential outflows during this 30-day period. And all these in detail are listed in the annex to the press release that also is in front of you. In addition to this, by tomorrow we will produce the full rules text, as it is called, with the details of the agreement. It's about 60 pages with details when it comes to how to define all these things. But let me finally also add that, as far as I'm aware, the Basel Committee has been discussing liquidity issues since probably sometimes in the 80s. In the early days, those conversations were quite informal, and they did not produce detailed agreements on how to deal with liquidity. So to get to an agreement, to agree on a formalized framework the way we now have done, I do think it's quite an achievement and something that will be very, very helpful when it comes to ensuring global financial stability. Thank you.
The speakers will now switch off their microphones.
Those in the room have priority to ask a question. Please press your microphone, ask your question, and then the speakers will reply. Thank you very much.
Governor, Mr. Ingves. Jeffrey Smith from Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. last year, the BCBS said it would not be making any material changes to the LCR. These look like very material changes. Can you perhaps kind of give us some kind of figures as to how much in absolute terms you've broadened the stock of eligible assets, either level one or level two, specifically as regards the residential MBS, because obviously that was a huge point for the American banking sector. I mean, to what size, what dimension of new eligible assets have you created with these changes?
Let me just make a general comment and then pass on to Stefan. It's in the eye of the beholder as to whether these are material or not. Clearly, one of the aims of this was to listen to the comments that people had made and continue the debate about what assets should comprise the definition of high-quality liquid assets. And I think the issue here is about their ability to act as liquid assets, and I think to include some equities. The definition of mortgage-backed securities which are eligible impose quite strong restrictions on the type of assets which are eligible. So there has to be RMBS, which include skin in the game for the lenders. So it isn't just the sort of asset that was known as RMBS before the crisis. So there are certainly restrictions. But I think the key point to make about this is that in the course of the debate, I think the committee and the regulatory community more generally felt it was appropriate to broaden the class of liquid assets because they did add to liquidity. That doesn't mean to say it's a sort of it's a loosening of the whole regime, because the capital requirements on those assets mean that it doesn't provide necessarily a strong incentive for banks to hold those types of assets. They still got to provide the capital to hold them. And one shouldn't forget that when thinking about the impact of that on the balance sheet structure of the banks. Now, in terms of the quantitative impact, it obviously varies enormously from bank to bank. One general comment, and let me hand on to Stefan. Overall, we have looked at the figures, and the Basel Secretariat have analysed the figures for about 200 of the world's biggest banks. The vast majority of those banks already hold liquid assets well above the minimum required by this standard. Not all, but the vast majority are already above that standard. So I don't think this is something which immediately imposes a new additional burden on the banking sector. They're already there, and of course the standard doesn't kick in fully until 2019. But Stefan, you want to comment on the...
Yeah, in addition, if we look at the banks that report the LCR numbers to us, with these changes, on average, I think the LCR would go up from, let's say, 105 to 125 or something in that range. But then it's of course important to stress that when we're talking about averages, it's truly an average. So you will always have banks that are below, or some banks that are above, and that differs, of course, depending on what different banks have chosen for as a business strategy. When it comes to these added assets, what we have introduced is a second level of a layer of what we nowadays, with the language that we use when we have discussed this, called level 2B assets, and they are limited to 15% of the total, the numbers you also find in Annex 2, which is attached to the press release, because then there you have all the different percentages.
Another question from the room?
Holger Ali from Germany's Business Daily, Hansblatt, Switzerland's office. Just to understand it correctly, so does that mean that corporate debt and RMBS together can have maximal a weight of 15% in the HQLA? Is that true? Okay, thank you. And before it was zero, or what?
Hello, Peter Oliver from RT. I've got a question for Mr. King. Does the publishing of a charter by the committee suggest that it's turning towards more transparency to the public of what's being discussed in the rooms?
Well, I think we've always tried to be transparent, but I think the point here was just to write down and put down in a public document more about the composition, membership and governance of the Basel Committee process, including the meeting of governors and heads of supervision, which is the oversight body. And this has evolved quite a lot. It's not that many years ago since this was basically a G10 group of central banks. It's expanded its membership considerably, and in the process of that, the whole governance arrangements have changed as well. And I think this is an attempt to explain to you and the world in general what those changes amount to, and so you actually have a document you can turn to which sets out the governance of the arrangements for the Basel Committee.
Hi, Giles Broom from Bloomberg News. I'm just wondering if you could reflect on why it took quite some time to get to the position we are now in terms of forming an agreement. And it was one of the issues that introducing these measures would make it harder for some central banks to implement their monetary policies. And do you feel that they've that you've got to the point now whereby they are happy that they are able to do that without being encumbered by these provisions?
Well, the answer on that is clearly yes, because this was an agreement reached unanimously today. I think the reason it's taken another year of work is if you look at Annex 2 to the press release and you see the complete set of agreed changes, then what you can see is that there are a lot of details in that. And these details have to be, it's not just a group of people sitting in Basel trying to work out the answer by lunchtime and then writing it down. This has to be agreed by a very large number of countries internationally. And that's a big effort. And Stefan and his colleagues deserve great credit for the amount of time and commitment they put into this. And the Basel Committee met for the last time in the middle of December and reached an agreement which was put to the governors and heads of supervision this afternoon, and we endorsed that agreement unanimously. So I think anything that with this degree of detail is bound to take time. And what was important is that we were prepared to take the time to get it right. People did criticise some of the details from the earlier proposals, and we said we'll look at it. You know, if there's a good case for changing either the definition of liquid assets or the runoff rates to define the denominator of the ratio, we'll look at it and we'll change it. And we looked at it, and in some cases we did change it. Not in all, but we did look at it very carefully. And I think that's it was well worth spending the time to get it right, because this is an agreement that's going to affect banks for a number of years.
Can we perhaps have a question from one of the participants dialing in?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please dial *14. I repeat, *14. And we do have a first question coming from... Hold on. I have a few questions coming up. The Financial Times first. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Brooke Masters from the Financial Times. My question is, do you see this as having made the liquidity coverage ratio more realistic, or is this truly a relaxing because it was too strict beforehand?
Brooke, I think we would say it's the former. Nobody set out here to make it either stronger or weaker as a standard, but to make it more realistic, as you said, to examine the arguments that have been put forward about the liquidity of different types of assets, the runoff rates in particular, and, of course, also the transitional timetable in order to make sure that there was no impediment to the financing of the recovery, but moving to the ultimate standard by the same date as the capital requirements also come into effect. So I think that we would regard this as a realistic approach. It certainly did not emanate from an attempt to weaken the standards.
Thanks.
Next question from the telephone. Yes? Thomson Reuters. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello, it's Hugh Jones here, Reuters. You mentioned the net stable funding ratio. Does the Basel Committee and the GHOs expect this to come fully into force by 2019 as well?
The answer is yes.
Next question from the floor, the BBC. Go ahead.
Hello. Oh, hello, it's Robert Peston from the BBC. I've got three pretty, I hope, simple questions. One is, when you say that the vast majority of the world's biggest banks already meet the requirement, do you mean the 2015 reduced requirement or the full 2019 requirement? You have this interesting change when it comes to the equivalence of central bank operations, reducing the outflow rate on maturing secured funding transactions with central banks from 25% to 0%. Is that designed to prevent some kind of a funding crisis for Eurozone banks. Plainly, we're approaching a sort of refinancing issue on the LTRO. And then finally, how difficult was it to agree to include high-quality RMBS? After all, from the summer of 2007, it was impossible to sell a penny of RMBS. One might argue it's a slightly odd choice for inclusion.
On the first issue, when it comes to the level of the LCR, if one were to use the old definition, then with the group of banks that report to us, then it would be around a little bit more than 100% as of now. With the changes to the LCR, I'm talking about on the average now.
Yeah.
It would be 125, around 125.
But on 2015 or on 2019?
No. That's now. But right. Then, given that
of the percentage of the standard that will apply in 15 or 19,
if one were to use the LCR the way it has been agreed now, the LCR ratio, the way it is measured, would be on average around 125.
And that's on full implementation.
That's on full implementation. That's not 60% and moving up. But then, right. Of course, when you look at different banks, then there can be quite a dispersion.
Okay. So some are way above and some are below.
So some are above and some are below. And then by starting at 60% in 2015 and having a gradual process, then the banks that need to adjust to this will have enough time to make those adjustments in such a way that there are no difficulties with the adjustments in the financial sector. On the second question about central bank eligibility, when one starts working on a liquidity coverage ratio, it becomes clear early in the process that one way or the other, given that central banks lend to banks, the role of the central bank has to be dealt with in one way or the other.
Sure.
And the key there, which also Mervyn King stressed, is that central banks deal with banks, and money is passing from central banks back and forth to banks. While at the same time, when it comes to liquidity, one would like to ensure that central banks truly stay as lenders of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we have tried to find and tried to deal with, and what we will continue to deal with in this year, is this issue of, on the one hand, dealing with the fact that when central banks, for example, conduct monetary policy, you actually buy and sell securities, or you lend to banks, and you do all sorts of things, and those things affect one way or the other the LCR. And then there's more technical work to be conducted to ensure that system will work properly. On the final question about the RMBSs, it's really about how you define them. And there we have a quite tight definition of what kind of RMBSs can be included. And also, they are limited to the 15%, the level 2B part that we talked about earlier.
Sure.
And there are issues in there such that loan to value ratios, right of recourse loans, skin in the game, and issues like that. So there's quite a long list of restrictions on the RMBSs that can be included.
Robert, can I come in with one final comment on the access to central bank facilities? Because it became clear during the process of discussing all this that it didn't make any sense, really, to think about an LCR without having a clear view about what to make of access to central bank facilities. And, of course, this was linked to the question about the use of government bonds as high-quality liquid assets.
Yeah.
Although much of the public comment about this has been about those countries whose government bonds have fallen in value and become a lot less liquid, particularly in the periphery of the euro area, there are other examples of countries which have so little government debt that there isn't a large stock of government bonds to use as high-quality liquid assets. Both of these cases raise quite interesting questions about what to make for the LCR. And in the case of countries like Australia, there is a special arrangement which enables them to include some access to central bank facilities where there is a penalty charge imposed on the use of the central bank facility. And one of the things which the working group will take forward over the next year is how to think in a somewhat more coherent way about the interaction between the LCR on the one hand and central bank facilities on the other. This is very much at the heart of what we have to get, think through, because clearly, as I said in my original comments, that there are some circumstances where the only source of real liquidity is indeed from the central bank. And it's very important that we maintain the position in which banks do not see the central bank as the lender of first resort, but nevertheless, we still can find a way in which to allow the LCR to reflect access to central bank facilities. And that is something which is on the work program for the next 12 months.
That's great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
We have another question from the floor here in the room.
Yeah, Holger Ehrlich from Handelsblatt again. After the euro crisis, we could wonder if what is the final use of the LCR, because as you said before, central banks are last man standing to provide banks with liquidity. So at the end, if there's a crisis, I don't see any alternative than for central banks to provide liquidity for the banking system to prevent a breakdown. So if is this like that in the situation we have faced in Europe in the last years, what is the use then of this liquidity measure when at the end of the day it will be at central banks to step in?
Well, of course, this is a council of despair at one level. The point about this is that we hope we will not permanently be in a crisis as severe as the present one. And if you go back to before the crisis, into more normal times, as we hope we will return to eventually, it would make sense at that point to ensure that banks would have to be in a much worse position before they had to rely on the central bank. You're right that in the end, with a sufficiently large crisis, the central bank is indeed the lender of last resort and needs to be there. That's absolutely right. But that doesn't mean to say we should accept that in any and every circumstance, banks should be able to rely on the central bank and the central bank become the lender of first resort. So the purpose of the LCR is to make it that much less likely that banks will indeed have to rely on the central bank for access to liquidity. And of course, the key thing to point out about this crisis is that this crisis was not a crisis of liquidity. It was a crisis, in essence, of solvency. It showed up first in liquidity problems, but those liquidity problems would have been solved much more quickly by temporary access to the central bank if the cause of the crisis had indeed been a purely liquidity crisis. But it wasn't. As a solvency crisis, the problems got worse. Now, there is no way that the LCR can possibly hope to deal with a solvency crisis. Capital requirements are there to make a solvency crisis of this kind much less likely. So we'll have to see this as part of the overall Basel framework. On the solvency side, the capital requirements are absolutely fundamental. To deal with a temporary liquidity problem, the LCR is important in order to raise the bar at which the central bank needs to step in. But ultimately, the central bank always has to be there as a backstop.
Another question in the room?
Sorry, if I may again, Jeffrey Smith from Dow Jones and Wall Street Journal. Are there any specific measures which you've taken today which are designed at neutralising the negative impact on the interbank market of the LCR, that kind of incentivised bank, that would have incentivised banks to prefer central bank facilities over interbank facilities? And secondly, and this, even after today's agreement, there still seems to be a very large disconnect between what is internationally acceptable as a liquid asset and what you as central bankers are prepared to lend against. Can either of you gentlemen please give us an idea, either in absolute or proportional terms, as to the stock of outstanding assets that you would accept as collateral for your own monetary policy facilities, but which aren't viewed as HQLA?
Let me take that second one first, and then Stefan may want to come back both on that and on the first question. This just goes back to what I said just now. Of course, in the last resort, the central bank is there as the lender of last resort, and as such, it's willing to accept as collateral a very wide range of assets with haircuts. And the clear thing that distinguishes one asset from another is the haircut imposed, in other words, the amount of money that you can borrow against a valuation of that particular type of asset. There's no obvious reason why that should indeed be close to the definition of high-quality liquid assets. The whole point of the LCR is to make sure that banks behave in a way that makes it less likely that they will need to go to the central bank, except in a generalized systemic crisis when there may be nothing that one can do. But the fact that the central bank may at times need to step in as the lender of last resort is not a reason for not having an LCR and turning the central bank into the lender of first resort. On the other question, Stefan.
Right, that's a technical part, and this is one which appears at the bottom of page one of Annex 2, which is called Committed but Unfunded Interfinancial Liquidity and Credit Facilities. And there the percentage is moved down from 100% to 40%.
So if I understood that correctly, whereas banks had to assume that they would lose all their unsecured yes. bank funding, they can now count on keeping 60% of
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah. Do we have another question from those dialing in?
Next question is coming from the Independent. Go ahead. Hello. Your line is open.
Hello. Oh, yes. Hello. This is Ben Chu from The Independent. I just want to follow up on the comments that Mervyn King just made. Would it be correct to characterise the importance of this liquidity decision as being secondary in importance to anything that Basel might do on capital?
Well, I don't think when you look at a package overall that anything is secondary. I think the ultimate package will have three main parts. The capital requirements, which are all about the fraction of the total liabilities of a bank coming from its own capital, its equity. This is all about how the bank finances itself. And the net stable funding ratio, which is the next and absolutely crucial part of this package, will all be about the regulation of the residual part of the liabilities of the banks, that is how they finance themselves in ways other than equity, and it will be all about how much they're allowed to finance themselves at very short-term maturities and so on. So that the net stable funding ratio and the capital requirements are all about the liabilities side. The liquidity coverage ratio is about having enough liquid assets to avoid what may be a relatively soluble problem in a bank becoming something really serious through a shortage of liquidity. So it's certainly fair to say that in terms of a systemic crisis, that the issues about the amount of capital and the net stable funding ratio will be more important. I don't think, however, it means that the liquidity coverage ratio is unimportant, because it can prevent what might otherwise be a relatively small problem becoming something really serious, and that is a very important objective.
Well, let me add that one way of thinking about the liquidity is to say that given that we accept what is called fractional reserve banking, given that deposits are not backed to 100%, then liquidity is and always will be an issue. And for that reason, it really makes a lot of sense to think through how to put in some kind of restrictions when it comes to the amount of liquid assets you need to hold, because we do know that if you don't have enough liquid assets, individual banks will run into serious trouble and will be forced to deal with the public sector sooner or later. And the more liquid assets you hold, the better off you are, in the sense that these issues can be managed and sorted out within the private sector itself. And it's a major achievement if we can make the system work that way, so that the regulators truly have to step in later rather than sooner.
Thank you.
Next question is coming from Financial Times.
Hi, it's Brooke again. In your statement on the fact that central banks will be able to suspend the liquidity coverage ratio in times of crisis, is this essentially a restatement of the statement that came a little while back that said obviously banks can dip into their buffers, or is this going further than that?
No, I think it's trying to make absolutely crystal clear to everyone, including the regulators at times, that these buffers are there to be used. And I think one of the problems which occurred in the last year or so was that a number of market participants basically assumed that banks had to hold liquid assets over and above the LCR, or their national liquidity guidance, in order to provide an operational buffer. In other words, that the regulatory buffer was not one that could actually be used. That, of course, would be completely self-defeating. There is no purpose at all in having a regulatory liquidity buffer which cannot be used. And I think it was very, very important to make clear to everyone, in case there was any doubt at all, that the liquidity coverage ratio is something which can be used in stress conditions by any and all banks. They're there to be used not to hold liquid assets over and above the LCR in order to avoid running down below the LCR figure. That the LCR is there to be used. And in that sense, it is a restatement of where we were before, but I hope it's a clearer restatement and one that no one will mistake in future.
Can a bank decide on its own to dip into the LCR, or does it have to tell its supervisor first?
It's the supervisor that will have to decide whether or not it's allowed to use the buffer.
Super. Thanks.
Next question is coming from Wall Street Journal.
Hi, David Enrich with the Wall Street Journal. The thing I'm a little unclear about here is, and we're saying that on the one hand, the vast majority of the world's biggest banks already are above the LCR, they meet the LCR. And on the other hand, there's a widespread perception out there, I think, including among many regulators and central bankers, that especially in the Eurozone, the state of liquidity at these banks is weak at best. And so I'm just wondering if that's a paradox or if I'm missing something.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the reason why banks are above the ratio in part is because most banks are completely overflowing with liquid assets. And the reason for that is that the major central banks have expanded their balance sheets so much that central bank reserves are now enormous, and they count as liquid assets. So for most banks, it is hardly surprising that they're above the ratio. It reflects the way in which central banks around the world have expanded their balance sheets in order to provide stimulus to the economy. Now that's, we hope, isn't a permanent feature. So there will be a point when this will start to become more binding than it is now. Of course, you point out that in some countries, some banks are perceived as in a more difficult position. I think that's true, although I think the really fundamental problem in those cases is solvency, not liquidity. But the reason why overall the picture looks reasonably good at present is merely that it's a mirror of the extent to which central banks have expanded balance sheets and created central bank reserves.
Okay, so in other words, in a sense, so it's not that we should be taking from this the sense that the banking industry is in great shape, nothing for the banks to worry about here. It's more of a mirage based on kind of the state of the central bank, the state of activism among the world's central banks.
Well, it's not a mirage because it's a reality. I mean, they do have very large reserves with central banks, and they count as liquid assets. I think what all this adds up to is a statement that the LCR, because it comes into effect fully only in 2019, and because there are very large central bank reserves out there today, this is not going to be binding and hence damaging to the banking system today. And banks have a long period now in which to adjust their plans for holding liquid assets to reflect, first of all, the transition period, and secondly, the fact that we hope that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we'll be getting back to a more normal world in which they will have to find liquid assets other than central bank reserves.
Yep, okay. But banks have a lot of work to do.
Over a long period.
Good, thank you.
The next question is coming from Het Financieele Dagblad.
Yes, hello. This is Cor de Hoorde with the Dutch Financial Daily, Het Financieele Dagblad. I have a question on the RMBS. And with today's decision, probably the market could revive. But on the other hand, In December, the Basel Committee published a report to strengthen the capital requirements for holding RMBS. Is this a sort of trade-off between the liquidity standard and the capital standard?
The answer to that is very simple. It's no.
That's clear. The publication in December is still under discussion, so that would still be trained.
What we are dealing with today is the liquidity coverage ratio and what one how one can think about liquidity and deal with liquidity when it comes to banks. Talking about capital, that's a different topic. It's a different day. And there is no connection between the two. The decision here is that it's reasonable to in some instances, with very tight definitions of RMBSs, include them up to the 15% level of, which is included in the level 2B group.
I see. I see there's a difference between a capital and liquidity standards. However, and when it comes to revising markets. Perhaps marketplace will see them as together.
Do we have another question in the room?
Giles Broom from Bloomberg News. I'm just trying to get my head around what qualifies as liquid assets. Can you just explain a bit about how covered bonds count? Can they count for 100% of a bank's LCR buffer? And secondly, just going back to the report based on the end of 2011 and the shortfall of assets of 1.8 trillion in terms of what banks have at the moment, and what they're required to have under the LCR. Can you say whether the changes you're outlining today considerably narrow that shortfall, and if so, by how much, or whether you'll actually give us a comparable figure in future?
No, on the latter, I can only give you the averages today that I've talked about in general terms, and how the whole thing kind of moves up given all these changes. And then the covered bonds are part of what is called level 2B. That's where they are, and it has stayed that way during the whole period. So there are no changes there.
One last question, which will close the GHOS press conference.
We have a question on the phone, too, actually.
Go ahead.
Okay, we have the Bureau of National Affairs. Sir.
Yes, good evening. Daniel Prusen, the Geneva correspondent for BNA in Washington. I was wondering if you just briefly reiterate to me what the changes were in regards to the haircut figures. I don't have the original figures that were proposed, so what were the original ones the Basel Committee had proposed? And secondly, I don't quite understand, if you say that most of the world's leading banks are already well above the requirements set out today, as of today, then why is extra time needed in order to have them meet these legally binding obligations? Thank you.
Well, let me take the second and then leave the more detailed question to Stefan. I mean, the point is that even though banks may hold more liquid assets than the standard would require today, that still leaves open the question of whether those assets are acting as a substitute for investing in a higher loan book. And so it's still possible that the liquidity requirements imposed not by the regulator but by the market, perhaps, are in fact providing an incentive for banks to either deleverage more or to expand their lending by less than they would otherwise have done. And since we attach great importance to trying to make sure that banks can indeed finance a recovery, it does not make sense to impose a requirement on banks which might damage the recovery.
And in that sense, the whole point of the standard is to reach agreement on a standard where banks know that there is a time period to which they can adjust to it without having to sacrifice an expansion of lending, which would be potentially damaging to the real economy. And that's the reason for doing that. It's not just that you look at the assets they've got now and say, oh, well, if they've got the assets, that's fine. We introduce it now. It's what is the impact of having to hold that degree of assets, which may be something which the market is imposing at present on their ability to finance a recovery. And what we wanted to do was to make sure that this was not seen as being imposed by the regulator. It may be being imposed by the market, but it's not being imposed by the regulator. There is a lengthy transition period before banks actually have to meet the standard.
On the other part of your question, the thing about the percentages, there is an Annex 2 which is attached to the press release, which is includes, it's more than a page and a half with percentages. So I'm not going to go through them here percentage by percentage. It's just too many of them. But I'm convinced that people in the Basel Committee Secretariat can help you out with the technical details of all of this, because there are no secrets and nothing strange about it. It's just a good number of percentages in here.
Okay. I'm sorry. Specifically, I wanted to ask about the HQLA, the 50% haircut for corporate debt securities and certain unencumbered equities, which are now subject to a 50% haircut. I was wondering what the earlier figure was. Sorry, I wasn't clear on that.
I mean, they were not in at all, so they did not exist.
Okay, thank you.
Let me thank you all for coming to the press conference, both in person and on the telephone. Let me add that for those who don't have access to the physical press release at present, it's embargoed until 6:30. It'll be on the website, BIS website then. And the lengthy document of around 60 pages, which spells out all the details in excruciating detail, which I know that you will all be very keen to see, will be available at around noon tomorrow. So it's a pretty short time to wait till you get the full details. And that you will get tomorrow. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.